full meal. The Skylight Cafe offers several lunch and dinner options, including vegetarian and halal choices. The Skylight Cafe is located in the Student Center building on HFCC's main campus and is open for your convenience from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Thursday and 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Friday. When you're on campus, be sure to check out the Skylight Cafe.
To be a good father is the most important job in a man's life, but it doesn't have to be hard. Play catch, go to a park or visit a zoo. Help your child with their homework. Sit down together for dinner. Ask them how their day was. Things get busy, and sometimes we all fall short. But the smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today.
Learn more at 1-877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves. And for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. And our guest today is Mr. Richard Dolan. Mr. Dolan holds an MA in history from the University of Rochester and a BA in history from Alfred University. He earned a certificate of political theory from Oxford University and was a Rhodes Scholar finalist. In 2000, he published a 500-page study entitled UFOs and the National Security State. And his second edition to the trilogy contains more than 600 pages. This is a three-part historical narrative of the national security dimensions of the UFO phenomenon from 1941 to the present. And he's working on part three as we speak. And these case studies demonstrate that the U.S. military has taken the topic of UFOs seriously for decades. Mr. Dolan took time out from this massive project to write his latest book, AD After Disclosure. Here to tell us about his work is Richard Dolan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, David. Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, it is our pleasure indeed. I have read most of this tome that you have written. I met Mr. Dolan in Laughlin and purchased a copy of his book.
That's volume two of the history.
Volume two, yeah.
Right, yeah.
And it's really a very in-depth study of many, many cases and very objective, I would say.
Thank you.
If you think that there's nothing to a certain case, you let the reader know it. And I really appreciate that in a work, because there's too much garbage out there, too much disinformation.
Mark Twain once said, "When in doubt, tell the truth."
Yeah, right. That's right. Very good. And so your collegiate education is in history. Or what prompted your interest in the history of UFOs?
Well, that's a good question. I did not grow up with a particular interest in UFOs. I would say that I had an average interest. That is, I think most people, if you ask them, you know, are you interested in UFOs, they might say, oh, yeah, why not? They're kind of interesting. And I think that was probably my situation, but I had never followed up into it until I was well into my 30s. I was doing a great deal of doctoral dissertation research on Cold War strategy, Harry Truman and the CIA and the Russians and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a bookstore, and I saw a copy of Timothy Good's excellent book called Above Top Secret, The Worldwide UFO Cover-Up, and that was on a display, actually, in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I picked it up off the shelf and flipped through the pages, and one thing led to another, and I thought, wow, I'm kind of interested in this because he's writing about a lot of the people I'd studied in my academic work, except he's connecting them to UFOs. If there's anything to this at all, why have I never read about it in an academic context? I mean, why is that not interesting?
Mm.
Very interesting. So I bought his book. I'd started doing a lot of research on the what was then the Internet, basically a lot of bulletin boards and news groups. And the next thing I knew, I was hooked completely and ended up writing a 500-page history, which came out in 2000, revised in 2002, and then wrote lots of articles, did a lot of public speaking and so on, and finally, last year, wrote the follow-up, which is even longer than the first, and that is getting us toward the modern era, toward our own day.
Mm-hmm.
Those two volumes cover the first 50 years of the modern era, from the early 40s up to 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I tried to be objective, actually. Basically, my goal in writing this history is to capture really three important threads of the UFO history. The first thread, I guess, would be the phenomenon itself. And so, in other words, almost in an encyclopedic way, if someone were interested in a particular case, ideally they'd be able to look into my books and say, oh, I wonder what Dolan has to say about the Gulf Breeze case of the late 1980s, early 90s, and you could go to the book and you could find everything that I think is worth saying about them.
Right.
I try to be concise, but I try to be complete, and as you mentioned, I don't feel the need to be the judge and pounding the gavel on the desk every single time.
Mm.
I certainly have formed opinions about some of these cases, and I don't mind sharing them, but I try to have a light touch with all of that, because opinions can be wrong. What I try to do is simply lay out the known research, the known facts as they are.
Right.
So that's one strand, would be the cases, the phenomenon itself. Another thread of my work, as I'm sure you were able to gather in reading it, would be, I guess, loosely speaking, the politics. That is, is there a cover-up? Is there an attitude taken by the military or intelligence community about UFOs or by other governments toward UFOs? Do U.S. presidents have any involvement in this? And if so, what would it be? And who's in charge and altogether? Is it the president? Is someone else? And so that's a very big part of the issue, and including any kind of intelligence community infiltration of the UFO field. I feel that that's very important. And in the course of Volume 2, there was actually quite a bit that I discussed. And then the third and final major thread would be the research itself. And in the process of writing, especially the second volume, for me personally, that turned out to be almost maybe the most interesting part of the book. The phenomenon itself is fascinating. The politics are fascinating. But the research into UFOs it's really part of our own intellectual history.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it really had not been addressed, in my view, really adequately in any previous history on this topic. And what I really wanted to do, what I felt was important, was to capture our attempt in the 1970s and 80s, of course of Volume 2, at understanding this amazing mystery. And what people thought about it in the early 70s was not necessarily what they were thinking by the early 90s.
No.
And how we got from point A to point B, that's a fascinating story.
Right.
And really just weaving all those three threads together, hopefully into something that reads well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. It really does. Now, I think you mentioned the politics involved, and we were talking about opinions as opposed to laying out the facts. I think the politics come in when people start giving their opinions on these cases. Yeah, this is right. Don't look at this guy's data. Look at mine, because
it's inevitable, really.
Yeah.
I have a lot of sympathy for a lot of these debates, and we would like everything to be nice and neat and tidy. But the fact is, look, it's not just ufology. It's all of the academic world in general. No one agrees. I come out of the field of history, and whether you're reading Journal of Soviet Studies or the Journal of American History or some other publication in the historical field, people always argue. That's just how it is. You know, sometimes in the UFO field, we forget. We think, like, we're the only field where there's division and dissension, and in fact, it's the norm. And, you know, in terms of understanding a phenomenon, you have to interpret. We would like to say just the facts, but in truth, even our selection of the facts is always going to betray our particular point of view as, you know, what we consider to be an important fact.
Right, right.
And so we're never going to be able to eliminate that messy thing called human judgment.
No.
That's part of the game.
No. I give a lot of opinions on my show, too.
Well, there you go.
You know, but the point is, I think your book is good because you lay out the facts.
Yeah.
You know,
We can have we can have opinions, but we can also try to have a light touch. And
right.
I did really genuinely try to have a light touch. I didn't want to slam the reader over the head with what I think is going on.
Mm.
Although I think any perceptive reader is going to have an idea of what I think is going on.
Right. Now, I don't know. I think that, you know, I've talked about disclosure and the need for disclosure. You talk about disclosure. Everybody talks about disclosure. But do you think that, you know, with all of this going on right now, the National Press Club, pilots and military coming forward, and a lot of, even in fiction, the event on TV and all this. Do you think that instead of, like, the president coming out and saying, my fellow Americans, we're not alone in the universe, do you think that they're laying it out there and allowing these books and allowing these documentaries to be shown and until it becomes self-evident to people that this is a real phenomenon?
In a way, but no, actually, I don't think that that's, in fact, what's going on. But what I do think is happening is, I'm glad you brought this up, because, right, a lot of people in this field seem to believe that there is a government program behind the scenes somehow to acculturate or acclimate the public to the reality of an extraterrestrial presence.
Mm.
Or at least have a non-human presence, whatever these other beings are. And in fact, I think it's the opposite. I think that if anything, if there's an official policy, it's to defuse and to disable the topic. The problem that they're facing is that our world, we are the ones, we the people around the world, are the ones who, by our very nature, are pushing this disclosure.
Mm.
In other words, look, think of it this way. All right, we're now in the year 2010, almost 2011, we're not in 1990, we're not in 1960, we're not in 1940.
Hmm.
In other words, we have an internet, we have YouTube, we have smartphones, we have all these ways of communicating with each other that did not exist even 5 years ago for some of these things.
Right.
China is in the news with UFOs. Why? 20 years ago, they would not have been in the news, because 20 years ago, they were a much more tightly controlled society. But today, China, you know, they have a heavy-handed government and some censorship, but in reality, China is almost pretty much like the U.S. They all have their cell phone cameras, and they've all got, they do have internet. They're a relatively much more open society than they were 20 years ago, by far.
Oh, definitely.
And so, in other words, what's happening is that around the world, we are seeing dramatic changes in our civilization, and these are the things that are pushing UFO information into the public eye. And it's, in fact, it's a matter of the powers that be being unable to stop the rising tide. You know, we're not going to be in a 2010, 2011 holding pattern forever. We're going to keep moving into the future on this timeline of ours. And there's going to be a year 2020, and there's going to be a year 2030. And all we have to do is ask ourselves, what are the technologies that we're going to have in 20 years from now? I mean, we can't even imagine, really. But whatever they are almost certainly going to be able to enable us to even make greater progress on this issue of UFOs and ET reality. Computers that will probably be more intelligent than a human being.
Mm-hmm.
This is widely expected in the artificial intelligence field. And so in that type of a world, can we honestly think that we're going to you know, be at a stalemate in terms of understanding the answer to the UFO issue. I don't think so. And so I think what we're seeing is a ever greater ramping up of our own society's ability to grasp and get this phenomenon, and that is what's putting it increasingly front row center in our public discourse.
I think one of the problems is that it's very difficult, even for the, as you say, put it, the powers that be, to wrap our heads around the fact that, number one, we're not alone in the universe. Number two, we're not the most intelligent beings or more highly advanced beings in the universe. And, you know, I really do believe that, and here comes that opinion again, but I believe that they started out in 47, even 42, with the Los Angeles sightings.
Right.
They made up their minds that, you know, as soon as we get a handle on this and know what we're dealing with and are in control, we're going to tell the people about it. And that, here we are in late in 2010, and that day has not come.
No, it hasn't, but I actually think that it's going to come.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look over the history of UFO secrecy, and in fact, I really go into this, and my co-author and I go into this in quite some detail, in our new book, AD After Disclosure, AD After Disclosure.
Right.
Just because there's been secrecy, profound and successful secrecy on this topic, for more than 60 years now, doesn't mean that it's going to be able to continue like that for the same amount of time. In fact, I really think it won't. If you go through the history of the cover-up and the attempts to end secrecy, you'll find in every decade of the post-World War II era, there's been a significant attempt to break the secrecy of UFOs in the 1950s, 1960s, in the 70s, in the 80s, 90s, and in the last decade, the first decade of the 21st century. Mm. There have been sometimes multiple attempts by civilian groups and sometimes military groups to end UFO secrecy. Now, they've all failed more or less, but it also would not be true to say that we're in the same spot that we were, as we were in 1950.
No.
We're in a very different situation, and what's happening is that that wall of secrecy is getting chipped away slowly but inexorably. And the real thing that's changing now, as I've been saying, is the nature of our society. We are in a period of such rapid, incredible transformation as a civilization. There is no parallel of this. There's no previous example of this in all known human history. The rate of change is unbelievable. It's not just like, you know, like in the French Revolution where you had a big revolution that changed things. We're having major revolutions every decade. There's a new dramatic change in the way that we are living as a society.
Right.
So in that kind of a situation, I really believe something's got to give, and I think it's going to be the secrecy.
Sooner or later, huh?
I would even be so bold as to say within 20 years, I think it'll be over. I think we'll be living in a different mental world. That doesn't mean that we're going to have all the answers we want, and that doesn't mean that the president's going to have a little gray alien stand next to him on the podium and introduce him. You know, in fact, disclosure, I think, is likely to be messy. It's likely to be unsatisfying.
Right.
What I can imagine happening is, let's say, you know, another 5 years go by and we've got new technologies in the consumer market and public domain that somehow allow us, case closed, to have a mass sighting which a bunch of people record the same object, and somehow it gets out, and the powers that be can no longer deny it, and they have to say something.
Well,
what they'll do is, closure is going to be an impossibility until it must happen, and then it will happen, and it'll only happen because those individuals will want to control the spin, the public relations on it. They'll want to try to maintain as much control over that as possible.
And yet there have been sightings, like Bud Hopkins witnessed,
right,
where at least 20 people have come forward and admitted.
Yeah, it was in Lower Manhattan.
Yeah,
in the early 1989. It was you're right, a major case. Of course, it happened at in the middle of the night. It was like at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Well, yeah, okay. My sighting back in 62 was 11:30 at night, and hundreds of people saw this object, 200 feet in the sky. And they just, it was a northern light, so I go back to sleep,
No, but, absolutely. There have been many mass sightings. That's fascinating, by the way. And there, the mass sightings have continued into our own era now, but none of them have had enough, been able to get the traction necessary to cause an admission, but
right.
I will maintain. I believe that there's going to be something. It could be an accident, it could be, and it doesn't have to be a mass sighting, although I think that's probably where I put my money as the thing that causes a disclosure. But, I think that there will be something that will happen that's going to force this issue.
Mm. I need to take a moment here to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM on your radio, WHFR.FM on your computer. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with historian and author Mr. Richard Dolan. And we're talking about some of these cases that happened, since the 1940s. It goes back to what? Your first book goes back to 1942?
1941,
okay.
That's right.
So between the
of
one...
Of course, it goes back further than that. I mean, the phenomenon.
Oh, yeah.
Really, I think we can say is an ancient phenomenon.
Right. But tell us a few, talking about your second book, the second book in the trilogy.
Right.
Tell us about a few of the most prominent cases from 73 to 91.
Oh, yeah. There's no shortage of that. Probably one of the early spectacular cases of that volume would be it's kind of a famous case, the 1975 abduction case of Travis Walton, and some people know of it as the movie called Fire in the Sky.
Right. We just had him on not too long ago.
Mm. Well, Travis is a very, very decent man. I've had the pleasure to meet him a number of times in person, and his lovely wife, Dana. You would not meet a more humble and soft-spoken gentleman than Travis.
Right, right.
What happened to him in 1975, I wrote my own description of it, which, in fact, a couple of readers said, wow, great description of the Travis case. It's a situation where he was out logging with a bunch of his co-workers. They're finishing up the day. They're in this wooded area and near the town of Heber, Arizona. And they see this object, this kind of a glowing object descend from the sky. They're in the wooded area. Travis, who was riding shotgun there, he just gets out and walks toward this thing. His co-workers are shouting after him to tell him to come back inside, and he ignored them. He stood there, and according to the guys watching it, there were five other men watching him, the object shot a beam of light right into his chest. They panicked. They were all young guys. They panicked and took off. They drove off without him. 5 minutes later, they realized what a horrible thing they'd done in abandoning their friend. They drive back, and he was gone. And he remained gone for 5 days. Police with dogs combed the area. Gets cold out in that area at night, and Travis only had a jean jacket and a pair of jeans, and that was it. He turned up 5 days later in a nearby town, shivering cold, made a phone call from a phone booth. Long story short, he was subjected to several polygraph tests. His co-workers were subjected to polygraphs, and in the opinion of, I would say, most people who spent time looking into this case, the conclusion is that Travis Walton and his co-workers are telling the truth, mm-hmm. and he was gone and taken aboard a UFO, a flying saucer, whatever it was, for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
It's a heck of a case, and in describing that case, all I tried to do is to present the best... you work with the facts and really try to explicate this case as clearly as possible.
Right.
Heck of a case, though. 1975, in general, it was an amazing year, and the Walton abduction occurred in the midst of a tremendous wave of UFO sightings out in the western U.S., and in fact, really, all through the fall of 75, that's when Travis's abduction occurred,
right. There
was a wave of airspace violations of sensitive U.S. bases, military bases, all across the western and northern U.S. border. And we have records of these from U.S. military archives. We know that these events happened. So that you'd have a case where radar would track an object and ground witnesses would also see the same object, unidentified, unknown, maneuvering in extraordinary ways over restricted airspace.
Right.
In some cases, these objects would hover very, very low, as in the case of Loring Air Force Base in Maine and also Wurtsmith Air Force Base in Michigan, where objects were seen extremely low, like 500 feet, mm-hmm. hovering over, in the case of Loring, nuclear weapons.
Right.
Where, you know, you're not supposed to do that. to this day, we don't know what these objects were, but they had the ability simply to glide right in, hang out as long as they wanted to, and then just saunter on off.
Yeah, but, you know, where's the proof? That's what the skeptics are saying. Where's the proof?
What we want is proof. There's proof covers different things. You can have proof that our military has been interested in something, and we have proof of that. We have proof in the form of many hundreds of pages of very excellent declassified U.S. documents. These are not disputed documents. These are legitimate, and what they prove, they don't prove UFOs are alien. That's true.
Right.
But they do prove that the United States military has been intercepting and chasing unidentified flying objects for over 60 years. Mm. And according to the reports that we do have, according to the military reports, these objects very frequently engage in extraordinary maneuvers, capabilities. They can disable the electronics of our own fighter aircraft. We know this happened in a famous case from 1976 over the city of Tehran. That's an amazing case.
Tell us about that one.
Well, this had to do in September of 76, and now this is back in the days of the Shah, before the Islamic Revolution, so Iran was a very close ally of the United States. The U.S. had a very prominent embassy there. And what happened is that in the city of Tehran, one evening in September, a lot of citizens looked up and they saw this bizarre, very bright, intensely bright light in the sky. So some of them called the local airport. The airport, Mehrabad Airport, the operator looks, he doesn't even bother looking at it. The first couple of phone calls, he's like, yeah, right, okay, fine, whatever. Doesn't believe it. Eventually, he goes out to look because enough people are calling him, and he sees what they see. He sees this intensely bizarre, bright something in the sky. He ends up calling the Iranian Air Force, which, of course, was equipped fully by the United States. So they had F-4 fighters, which they scrambled to intercept this thing. Two F-4s in a row. Now, we know about this case because we have a detailed four-page type memo from the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, which describes this in detail. This memo went not only to the U.S. President, Gerald Ford, but it went to the director of the CIA, it went to the Secretary of State, it went to the National Security Council, Henry Kissinger, and all the military branches. Everyone was interested in this report. And what it described, these two F-4 fighters in a row, each of them, when they got to a distance of about 25 miles from this object, they both had it on radar. Pilots of both aircraft were seeing it visually. They said, this is incredible. It's enormous. When they got to that distance in succession, each aircraft lost its key navigation and electronics instrumentation, and they had to break off. In the case of the second aircraft, this guy was about to fire a missile at the object when all of this stuff went offline. And the object, this is the most incredible part, I think, detached a smaller object from it, which then pursued the F-4. So it came at the F-4 jet. The pilot engaged in an extreme evasive maneuver. He's turning away really tight. And this little, this smaller object turned inside his own arc, according to the document.
So
it had an incredible speed and incredible maneuverability. And then, in the words of the memo, returned for a perfect rejoin with the mothercraft. Now, all I can say is, what on earth, to put it mildly, can do that?
Yeah. Nothing
right? In 1976, no less, much less today.
Nothing today.
No. I mean, and this object, so it was able to screw with the electronics. An F-4, a fighter aircraft, is an outstanding jet.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, it was one of the top in the world. So, is it Soviet? Well, there's no evidence that this was Soviet technology at all. We don't know what this was. To this day, this was an amazing case. So, again, that doesn't prove UFOs are ET.
No.
But it proves, I would say, that the phenomenon exists and that it has been engaging and engaged by the militaries of the world for a long, long, long time.
Right. Well, there's this, Ted Rowe is his name. NARCAP, is that?
Yeah, that's Ted Rowe's...
Right.
He's a very fine investigator and researcher of UFOs. And NARCAP stands for National
Aerial
Aviation Research. Actually, I don't remember what it stands for. They study UFOs.
Well, no, they don't. They study UAPs.
UAPs.
It's unidentified aerial phenomenon.
That's right.
Now,
exactly.
And you know, if you change that around, it's no longer a UFO. Well, you know, you're chasing the same thing we are.
Because it's not necessarily an object.
Right.
That's the thing. Right. We don't know what they are.
We don't know what they are, but at the same time, you know, these UAPs have come down to the GROUND and left marks.
Sure have.
And, you know, so they have to be, at least some of them have to be objects. And the thing is, now, I respect the man. I respect the group. I mean, God love them. They're doing a great job in helping out to find out what's going on here. But they say, you know, we don't accept, at least Ted Rowe says he does not accept the fact that, or the possibility that they're extraterrestrial in origin. I respect that. Fine. That's a good opinion.
Well, you know.
But at the same time, if not extraterrestrial or other dimensional, then what? I haven't gotten an answer.
Every group, listen, the way I look at it, every researcher is out there staking out a particular place in the public sphere on this. There's a place for everyone, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these organizations, NARCAP is one of them, they are attempting to have a dialogue with the scientific community.
Mm-hmm.
So for them to start throwing out all kinds of opinions on what UFOs or UAP are is going to be a politically unwise move in dealing with that scientific community, which is hardly in the position of wanting to accept this phenomenon at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so... you find there are writers in the field, some of them my friends like Leslie Kane and Nick Pope, who will stake out a certain place in the public sphere, and they will explicitly say, I don't have a conclusion on this.
Right.
I don't know what we're dealing with. All I know is that there's something going on.
And we have to investigate it.
There are other people in the field, and I would say I'm one of them, who's willing to go a bit farther. And I'm willing to say that, yes, I think that not only is there a phenomenon, but there appears to be a cover-up going on. And if I were to throw down my opinion, I would say that it's very likely an extraterrestrial or at least non-human civilization.
Mm.
But now, if I do that, I will pay a price. And the price that I pay, and the other researchers like me who state this, is that they're going to get less mainstream attention.
Right.
And that's just how it is. And so we need researchers and organizations that are willing to connect with the mainstream.
Mm.
But we also need other researchers who are willing, I think, publicly to state more defined opinions as well. There's nothing wrong with that.
And stick their necks out a little bit, you know?
I beg your pardon?
And stick their necks out a little
bit.
Well,
yeah. I've been sticking my neck out for a while now. So I don't mind. I'm very happy. And I'm at a point here where, actually, I'm almost on the border between those two types of groups. Because I do try to have an approach that's very amenable to mainstream researchers, and I get many of them who write to me and tell me they like my work, which is gratifying. But I'm also not as conservative, I would have to say, as researchers like Ted or Leslie or Nick. And, you know, but we all have our place.
Well, Leslie Kane is going to be our guest. We have her scheduled, at least, for next month.
Well, she's an excellent researcher. Yeah. She wrote a very fine book. In fact, I feel she kind of hit the ball out of the park with this last one. She got a New York Times bestseller on UFOs. How tough is that?
Yeah.
She was able to do it.
Yeah.
And she did it, I feel, because she was very cautious.
Mm.
She didn't overreach, and she also got a couple of really great endorsements that helped, certainly, including John Podesta.
Yeah, I was going to say Podesta. Now, he's been involved with Clinton. He's now involved with Obama.
Right.
And
that's right.
Show my ignorance here. What is his position now with Obama?
Well, he was Obama's transition chief after Obama was elected.
Okay.
Podesta was the man who, I don't know, all of the duties of the transition chief involved in orienting and, you know, kind of getting the new administration up and running.
Right.
So, yeah, he's had the confidence of both of those presidents. And John Podesta is interested in UFOs. Back in the 90s, he was known as an X-Files fanatic.
Yeah.
But he's also quietly a believer in UFOs, I think that's fair to say.
Oh, yeah, he's publicly said the truth should come out, it's the
right.
law.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any indication, in your opinion, any indication to suggest that some, if not all, of the U.S. presidents, from Truman to Obama, have been advised of the UFO reality?
Well, we don't have hard data on this, but what we do have are stories coming from people who claim that they know this or that about certain presidents. Unfortunately, that's about what we have. Now, you know, collecting those stories is actually quite interesting, and some of the sources, I think, are absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me, and by the way, in my second volume of history in particular, I really tried hard to get to the bottom of some of those claims and finding out what do presidents know, and also in the first volume as well, to a slightly lesser extent. But I would say that Truman certainly knew, Eisenhower certainly knew, Kennedy certainly knew. LBJ, in my opinion, probably knew, but doesn't seem to have been too interested in it, and basically seemed to keep it at arm's length. Nixon knew. I'd bet a lot of money on that one. And then after Nixon, well, Gerald Ford, I would guess, was read into the program at some level. Jimmy Carter definitely knew. Reagan, yes. George Bush Sr., yes. Now after that, it gets to be a little tricky because it does start to look to me that the trend of the last 20-some-odd years has been to let the presidents know less than they want.
Hmm.
That would go for President Clinton. It would go for President Bush, George W. Bush. And I don't know enough to say about President Obama, but I did have one source that that said to me personally that Obama was briefed, but given just the bare bones.
Well, the bare bones would be yes, the phenomenon's real.
Right, right. Yeah. But that he has no influence over policy. At least right. That was the as was told to me.
I think the president's influence is no longer. I mean, you know.
We all kind of realize this when you look at all other aspects of U.S., you know, forget UFOs, just look at in general.
Mm.
How much power does any president truly have? Is it the president or the guy who puts him in the White House,
mm-hmm.
i.e. the coterie around people like David Rockefeller and the financiers? I mean, we all sort of know, I think, I'd like to think, we all can get it by now, that presidents aren't so much elected as selected
mm-hmm.
by powerful interests.
Corporate America.
Corporate America and corporate world.
Right, right, right.
Beyond America. We're talking international power structure.
Right, right. Need to take one more break to remind our listeners. They're listening to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. We're speaking with a historian and author, Mr. Richard Dolan. And we're talking about the presidents here and who knows what and who knows if they know. And I think the only people that really know the truth are those who have seen them firsthand, you know, up close and personal. I'm not talking about, ooh, I saw a light in the sky last night that I didn't know what the heck that was, you know. But
They say seeing is believing, and the
yeah.
more you see, the more you're going to believe. I would be inclined to agree with you. Among the general public, I think is certainly
right.
true. And there are people I've spoken to so many of them who've had what I guess they would describe as abduction experiences.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that people should remember is that these experiences frequently are very difficult to handle emotionally. They're traumatic.
Mm-hmm.
And the individuals who've gone through these are, generally speaking, live through their lives without telling nearly anyone mm-hmm. about this. Because, well, they know they're laughed at, or they will be ridiculed, or their closest friends won't believe them.
Mm.
And people have lost friendships. They've lost family.
Yeah, I know.
Over this reality, and that's a fact. And so...
Idiots like me go on TV and radio, you know?
Yeah, well, have you paid a price as well, then, personally?
No. Not really, no.
Good. I'm very glad.
Not yet, anyway.
Well, you know, I think... thank goodness, maybe it has something to do with the fact that you're a very emotionally healthy person, I hope, and maybe the friends and family around you are.
Yeah.
But not everyone is in such a great position where they have people who are supportive.
Well, my family were with me when we had the sighting.
Well, see, now they're stuck there in there with you. So they have to support you. That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
It's good that you have, actually, and I assume have had over the years, that support network.
Right.
But, you know, you and I both know that a lot of people have this happen to them, and they deal with it in a very isolated, kind of atomized way. And
yes.
That's just not healthy. But and, they do know.
And some of the reports just get, you know, just weird. I mean, you know, way out of sight. More than I saw some craft in the sky I couldn't explain, but especially the abduction reports. Just
well, I'll give you an example. I had a person in my office here. I mean, not everyone that I deal with in a business context knows that I'm a UFO researcher.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, though, is that when they walk into my office, they see one entire wall filled with UFO-related books. So inevitably, they'll look over to their right and say, oh, I see you like UFOs.
You like
well,
them.
Like isn't quite the word. Maybe obsessed by. But this one woman said, oh, yeah, I don't really believe in that stuff. And I said, well, you know, fine, because guess what? I'm not here to convert you, in other words. Mm. Then she went on to describe these strange dreams that she would have.
Hmm.
And I'm thinking, here we go.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, she would describe being taken by little people, put on a table, being examined, and
oh my God.
Yada, yada, yada.
But I don't believe in it, huh?
Right. Hmm. So I did something that I actually regretted right away.
Hmm.
I reached over and I pulled off a copy of Whitley Strieber's very famous book, Communion.
Hmm.
Anyone who knows a little bit about UFOs has probably heard of this.
Hmm.
Probably the single most famous book cover in all of UFO literature.
If not only for the cover, right?
Right. It's got that striking picture of this alien. So I pulled the book off the shelf and I said, well, do they look like this?
Hmm.
And this woman... I feel bad about it even to this day, and this was years ago, stopped, looked away, and said, I don't want to talk about this anymore.
Mm.
And she got very upset.
Yeah.
I quickly put it away, and I apologized. I felt very, very bad. And we moved on to other things, and we were okay after that. But, you know, it was something that was very deeply disturbing to her.
Yeah.
And there's no question it's disturbing to a lot of people, and... really, the only way that a lot of folks can deal with it is they just push it out of their mind because it is it's disturbing when you get into the implications.
Yeah, now that picture on Strieber's book is artist conception. At the same time, there have been many reports of the book in the window of a bookstore and people freaking out when they see it. You know, that's it. That's the being I saw.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it is. It's a very arresting image, and I remember when I first saw it. It was not too long after the book was published, and I wasn't even interested in UFOs at that time.
Mm.
And I thought, "Oh my God, wow!" The cover blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
The more I think about it.
Yeah, there's also a picture out there supposed to have been sent to Whitley Strieber by someone in Canada. Of an alien being. He had allegedly had the camera up. He was an abductee, so he put a camera up there with a motion sensor and happened to capture this, allegedly capture this little gray being with the big black eyes. Are you familiar with that picture?
Offhand, I mean, I'm sure that I've run across this, but it's actually not ringing a bell with me.
Okay,
right.
I'll have to send you email you a copy of the picture. But I have taken that picture. Now, I'm not a photo analyst, but I have taken that picture and blown it up and looked over every square inch of that thing, looking for a seam in the costume, looking in the eyes. It would have to be something in the eyes, anything to give away a hoax. I can't see it.
Interesting. I'll have to take a look at it. Yeah, I'd love to see it. Well, we live in an era in which I think that type of evidence will increasingly become available.
Yeah.
Just because of our capability. The problem is going to be confirming it, actually, because, we live in an age of YouTube, and I think a lot of good data does get out there, but, of course, there's also falsified data.
Oh, yeah, that's the problem we have.
That's really going to be very, very difficult, I'm sure. But
separating the wheat from the chaff is a problem ufologists have, you know.
Absolutely.
And now, the UN has recently dubbed Maslin Othman as the official greeter to any contacted space species from space.
Well, if they send someone here officially, then she's the lady on the spot who's supposed to be in charge.
Well, yeah, but do you feel that this move tends to add an atmosphere of legitimacy to the UFO subject?
Maybe
with the UN taking part in it.
I've wondered about this, and I've tried to puzzle this one out as well. Like, why did the UN do this? They basically created an ambassador position to other alien species, really, when you think about it. And this is official. This isn't just, like, fun and games here.
No.
Of course, you have to assume, if that scenario were to happen, that there is to be open contact, that I don't think she would be the one on the spot. there'd be a lot of other more powerful players that would step right in front of her.
Oh, yeah.
But still, the fact that the UN did this, I've wondered if someone inside the UN was thinking, we're just going to make our own little play here because maybe they suspect that something might go down, and the UN may not want to just be completely lost in the shuffle in the event that something were to happen.
Right.
Now, that's simply speculation on my part.
You could say the same for the Catholic Church. The Vatican has come forward and said, they're one of they're space brothers. They're one of God's children, just like we are.
Absolutely. The most interesting thing is, the late Monsignor Corrado Balducci, he just died a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Balducci was a very close friend of the late Pope John Paul II, who was Pope for, over like 25 years,
right.
30 plus years. Balducci had said many times that not only was there life extraterrestrial life out in the universe, but he believed in UFOs, and he believed that ETs and other, entities, spiritual entities, were here, and that they were God's children, too. He was offering this as his personal opinion, but nonetheless, he was not only a close friend of John Paul II, he was the Vatican's official exorcist. Yes, they have such a position. And he was that guy. A demonologist, I think. Or is it the same? It's one of those. Exorcist or demonologist?
Same thing, I think.
He was high up and friends of John Paul II, and he's offering, his personal opinion. But nonetheless, the Vatican is like any other major bureaucracy and institution in that when you get to the upper levels, you don't just talk off the cuff about your own opinions. So,
without getting punished, unless they wanted them to, or condoned
or
it,
you're
at least
disciplined, or finding himself out in the boonies, so to speak. So
reduced to alder boy or something. I don't know.
Right. So Balducci, I've always felt, is a very interesting case that he was essentially allowed to sort of float these ideas out there and see how they would be responded to.
Right.
And the various Vatican astronomers have done more or less the same type of thing since. They've haven't gone quite as far as Balducci, but they have been very open about the reality, almost certainty of life elsewhere in the universe. And for them, for the Catholic Church, it's not a big deal. It's not a theological problem, I guess you could say.
No. But, I think they don't want to be Johnny-come-lately if the news should come out tomorrow, you know.
No, one of the interesting things that my co-author Bryce Zabel and I did for our book AD After Disclosures, we discussed religion and how really what we tried to do was act like a think tank would act and try to understand all the radical implications that a disclosure scenario would have on our society. And one of those elements is the religious part and the spirituality. And we spent a large amount of space really working that one out, dealing with the major religions of the world, how the Catholic Church would deal with it, how the various Protestant faiths would understand it, Islam, and then, you know, lesser faiths that are not as large, but like Mormonism is a pretty interesting case in point. We spent some time studying that one. Even Scientology and the Chinese new religion called Falun Gong, which has a number of adherents out there, and very distinct extraterrestrial beliefs. In other words, people's faith is going to be a very big factor in determining how they accept and deal with the reality of others living here on Earth with us.
So how do you think the Orthodox religions will be affected by UFO disclosure, or do you think they'll be affected?
I think they're all going to be profoundly affected, but the people, my own personal opinion about people is that once someone is in their 30s, they hardly ever change, ever. Usually good for like one big idea for the rest of their life before, and that's if they're lucky.
Yeah.
But what does change are generations. So they may not change, they may not have new opinions, but their children will, and their grandchildren will especially.
Right.
So in time, all of the major religions, I think, are going to be affected. Our understanding of spirituality in general will be affected.
Right.
But in the immediate term, I think what's more likely to happen is that people's religions and their systems of belief will affect how they interpret this very, very strongly. So what you'll have, like in the U.S., there's no question about this in my view, that evangelical Christianity is going to have a very distinct response to any kind of disclosure announcement. And what that response will include is a belief that these others, these other beings, are most likely Luciferian or demonic in nature. And in the course of researching this book, I spoke to many, many evangelical Christians, many of them good friends of mine, and really had some heart-to-heart talks. This is what they do believe, almost as a rule. Now, other faiths, say like Catholicism, is going to be a little more varied. The Roman Catholic Church in America and elsewhere has its very conservative elements, and it's got its very liberal elements. So that won't be unified in any way. But it will be positioned. It will be well positioned because of the Vatican's policies in the last decade to be able to accept this reality, I think, a little more quickly.
Right.
Islam, I think, will actually not have the most difficult time with this. Islam does allow for the reality of extraterrestrial life. It's not part of the creed of the religion, but it is absolutely in the Quran that Allah created many worlds.
Right.
And Muslims will, you know, tell you this right off the bat. And most Muslims personally that I've spoken to do not have a personal problem with the idea of extraterrestrial life.
Right. And do you think the world governments are afraid right now that the masses will demand a similar government to those of the visitors, to that of the visitors?
Well, that's a great question. My suspicion is that the political upshot of this is going to be, it'll be profound, and there will be, a lot of this is going to depend on our perception of who these visitors or who these others are, whether they're peaceful or not. Are they from another planet, solar system? Are they from another dimension? Are they from another time? Are they us in the future, or are they a breakaway human group from some other ancient history? Or, you know, are they the Atlanteans? We may not be able to get those answers in a disclosure scenario, incidentally. And so there may be a lot that's not known. I think there'll be enough fear in the world population that there will be a movement probably to promote a greater global cohesiveness as a way of responding to this challenge, maybe threat, certainly challenge. And it will spur developments toward a global type of government system, I think. Now, that doesn't have to be the kind of globalist system under domination right now by the world financial elite, the Rockefellers and Rothschilds and the Bilderberg Group. And, in fact, one of the main points in writing this book is that I really wanted to try to offer a different path. And in one of our final chapters, that is exactly what we did, to try to lay out how a U.S. president and other world leaders can, in fact, create a cooperative environment that maintains individual rights and really takes power back in the name of the people, but also enables us to coordinate our activities in a logical way. I mean, look, not even militarily, but let's just say UFO reality comes out. What that might mean is instantly we're all going to realize that petroleum may very well become obsolete, because after all, whatever these objects are using to get around, it ain't gasoline.
It isn't gasoline, no.
So that means there goes the world's largest industry.
And do you think do you think that is why the powers that be / petroleum industry, fossil fuel industry, does not want us to know?
There's no question in my mind that that's a key reason.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I should have mentioned this much earlier in our discussion, but we had so many other cool things to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, petroleum is, by any measurement, by most measurements that I'm aware of, is the single largest industry in the world today.
Mm-hmm.
It has been for years. And so, look, it's no trifling matter. You find, if there's some kind of free energy, something exotic, whether it's controlled nuclear fusion, which would burn clean, or something more exotic like the zero-point energy field, which people hypothesize about, or something else. Whatever that answer is, I can guarantee you, in a post-disclosure world, we are going to find out what it is pretty quick.
Yeah.
Because we're going to know there's a solution, and it's not going to be long. And so when we find that solution, there's going to be tremendous pressure to move off of petroleum-based fossil fuels. And that's fine. For humanity, that's probably absolutely necessary. But what it will do is it's going to cause a great deal of economic and financial disruption. And again, for the ordinary guy and gal, that may not be the worst thing in the world. But for those who own all the goodies, it's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And it will also have repercussions throughout the financial markets anyway, which will affect everyone. Yeah. And so it's something that would need to be done in a sane, coordinated way. And that's yet another reason for an intelligent cooperation among the nations of the world, so that we can do this transition in a way that doesn't cause excessive disruption of our global economy.
If I were a betting man, I would put my money on electromagnetic propulsion systems as their propulsion systems.
Right. Well, they're using electromagnetism in some way, I think most of us would agree. And but is there a source of energy and power that feeds into that electromagnetism?
Right.
And that's just as important as the actual the source of power, I think, is a very important part of the puzzle.
Yeah. Richard,
and whatever that is, it'll replace petroleum, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Richard Dolan, where can people go to check on your book?
Well, I would say go to there's two places. One is my publishing company, which is Keyhole Publishing, keyholepublishing.com, excuse me. That's my personal site. I've had that up for a while, and there's a lot of interesting things up there, no doubt. My co-author, Bryce, and I have a great blog site. It's constantly being updated. It's fresh. We've got great new content. It's called afterdisclosure.com.
Hmm.
Afterdisclosure.com. I'd say go check it out. It's got everything you need. It'll link to all the cool things that he's got going on, that I've got going on.
Now, is that book out now?
It's out, yeah. It's been out for a little over a week now.
Oh, okay. I knew it was about to come out, so...
For the longest time, I kept saying, any week, and now it's out. I've got a couple of copies on my desk here.
Very, very good.
We've been shipping out. You can get it on Amazon.com. You can get it very easily right off of our website, afterdisclosure.com. It is also available in bookstores. If you don't see it yet in a store, you can go and ask for it and order it. and they'll be able to get it for you.
Wherever fine books are sold.
Indeedly do.
Richard Dolan, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and I hope we can do this again sometime.
Appreciate it, Dave. It was a very nice interview.
Very good. Thanks again. And if you have any questions or comments for me, to my listeners, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. And I want to take this opportunity to wish all of our loyal listeners a very happy holiday season and Merry Christmas and best of the new year. And please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
Hello. Magic Notebook? Can you hear me? Yeah. What? Yeah, I know. Yes, my normal music is missing. I know that. Okay. Hi, this is Jimmy. I'm your non-resident spaceman. And, you're with me, floating in a tin can. And, that's a good little non-resident spaceman. I'd like to pay a little tribute to the patron saint of Lost Spaceman. Play a little David Bowie. Occasionally that means I actually play Bowie, but most of the time it involves finding covers of Bowie. Whatever's available. Space is a very empty place. So, without more ado, this is The Bad Plus, and this is Life on Mars from the album Prague.